Start the program. And I would like to just say a few words about the introducer. So we say that we should never introduce the introducer, but I'm going to make an exception. Some of you may know Randy Antic already. Randy is becoming quite well known here in town. He just concluded a very successful speakers conference Monday and Tuesday, which hundreds of people, probably thousand maybe, attended, and with some very fine speakers, and it was a great success. And this is the second year in a row that this has taken place, and this is Randy's creation, and Randy ran it. So Randy is going to introduce today's speaker, Steve Miller. Please come to the podium, Randy.
Thank you. My objective is to introduce you to Steve and do it as quickly as possible. And the difficulty is when you look at his resume, he's had more than one job. So let me take you from top to bottom, just outlining it. We'll start with his education. By the way, Steve and his wife Jill are here today. Here's just a little bit of his background, and Steve will probably take you further. Education, a degree in economics from Stanford University, a JD from Harvard Law School, and an MBA from Stanford Business School. Business career. An executive at Chrysler Corporation, where he served in various capacities, including chief financial officer and eventually chairman of the board. And I'm sure he'll tell you a little bit about that. But those of you who are from Detroit will know that he was in the middle of some amazing things that happened at Chrysler up through 1992. And then he retired, or said he would retire in 1992. Here's what happened after that date. From April 1992 to February 1993, he served as senior partner at James D. Wolfson, Inc. Then he served as chairman of Morrison Knudsen Corporation from April 1995 to 1996. Served as chief executive officer at Waste Management from October 1997 to 1998. Served as president of Reliance Group Holdings. Served as special advisor and then chairman from September 2000 to 2001 at Aetna. Served as chief executive officer at Federal Mogul Corporation, September 2000 to January 2001, and then came back again as the interim chief executive from July 2004 to June 2005. He then served as chief executive officer of Bethlehem Steel Corporation. How are we doing? A lot more than I did. He was then the chief executive officer at Delphi Corporation from July 2005 to 2007. He's the chairman of the board of the executive board of MidOcean Partners, which he joined in December 2009. Now, when most of us are down here and retired, July 14th, 2010, I'll read the announcement. Insurance giant American International Group said that his chairman, Harvey Gulub, has resigned due to tensions with the company's chief executive, Robert Ben-Moshe. Steve Miller, a fellow AIG director, has succeeded Gulub as chairman of the company's board of directors, effective immediately. He currently serves on the following boards: MidOcean Partners, AIG, Symantec, Kendall Jackson, and I believe Pope and Talbot. So here's an interesting question, which I think we can all relate to. If we were to talk to Steve's dad, who is not alive, and we were to ask him, he might say, "I'm proud of you, son. You have done you've had an extraordinary career and helped many companies." And if we were to ask his mother that same question, she might say, "Can't you keep a job?" I introduce you to Steve Miller.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and Randy, thank you very much for that lengthy introduction. I kept thinking the word drifter comes to mind. It's a real honor to be invited to speak to you all here. As you may know, for Jill and I, we are now, since late 09, we are Florida residents. We are year-round residents of Florida, and very proud to be here, and we just love the lifestyle. So we know why you're all here, and that's why we've come here. Yes, I've been associated with a lot of troubled companies over the years. You can look me up now in the yellow pages under Flaming Disasters. I am so often seen at the scene of the fire that all my friends call me the fireman. My enemies call me the arsonist. Let me go back over that resume a little bit here. To start at the beginning, I worked a dozen years for the Ford Motor Company and had some wonderful assignments in Mexico, in Australia, and in Venezuela. In the late 1970s, the then president of Ford, Lee Iacocca, got himself fired and ended up at the nearly dead Chrysler Corporation. Iacocca invited a bunch of us Ford types to come join his effort to save Chrysler. He was such a great salesman, I remember saying yes, accepting the job in his office, went out in the hall, and realized I had never asked what the salary was going to be. So at the ripe old age of 37, I got handed the job of negotiating the terms of Chrysler's survival with banks, labor unions, state and foreign governments, and thousands of suppliers. Now, to qualify for federal loan guarantees, we needed the unanimous approval of concessions from every single one of Chrysler's 400 banks all over the world. Ironically, it was the bank with the longest overdue loan that was the first bank to approve the Chrysler deal. And it was from my home state of Oregon. So I called up one of their directors to express my appreciation for their support and said, "Thanks, Dad." Well, after 9 long months of tense negotiations, we finally got signatures on the 10,000 required documents assembled on the 35th floor of a skyscraper in New York. And this was my dream come true, what I had worked for, but it was too good to be true. I looked out the window and saw clouds of black smoke coming up. A fire was raging on the 20th floor, turning the building into a towering inferno. We walked down those 35 flights of stairs and out into Park Avenue, now totally blocked off by fire engines. Huge sheets of 4x8 plate glass were bursting out and crashing into the street as the flames were leaping like 25 feet out over Park Avenue. I thought this was a a message from God about the evils of bailouts. But at midnight, we actually went back into the smoke-filled building and retrieved all those critical documents. Well, a decade later, and after having spent 25 years in the car business, I decided to move on. I became an investment banker, partnered with former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker and former World Bank President Jim Wolfensohn. I spent that year working on the world's biggest real estate crash, an outfit called Olympia and York that had developed some of the world's most spectacular commercial properties. The World Financial Center in New York, the massive Canary Wharf complex in London, and practically the entire skyline of downtown Toronto, Canada. Olympia New York was not a public company, but it was a huge private firm owned by three reclusive Orthodox Jewish brothers in Toronto. But it was, as they say, overextended, and went bankrupt under a $20 billion pile of debt. The morning we filed bankruptcy, I called a meeting in London of all the Canary Wharf workers in a big auditorium there. I knew they'd all be nervous about their jobs and benefits, so I carefully explained the bankruptcy process. When I asked if there were any questions, finally one hand goes up in the back of the room with the big question of the day. Will we still get Jewish holidays off? Shortly thereafter, I decided that working for a living was overrated. So in early 93, I abruptly retired and moved out west to Sun River, Oregon. Then I got a call from a stranger who introduced himself as the general counsel of Morrison Knutson, a big engineering and construction firm based in Boise, Idaho, that among other projects had built the Hoover Dam and the Alaska Pipeline and so on. My caller explained that the chairman CEO had just been fired, that cash was so low they'd miss payroll in a couple of weeks, and they were drowning in a complex web of shareholder litigation. How would I like to be the new chairman? Yeah, right. But I took the job. I didn't do any due diligence. It was a basket case. What else did I need to find out? The fired CEO at MK was a controversial guy named Bill Agee, who had previously scandalized Detroit as the CEO at Bendix when he had an affair with his young vice president of strategy, Mary Cunningham, now his wife. They had alienated the employees and the headquarters town of Boise by their regal lifestyle at corporate expense. It got so bad that the last 2 years of his tenure, he worked out of his house in Pebble Beach. His staff jetted down from Boise for meetings. It got so bad that whenever he came to Boise, and this is true, he took to wearing a bulletproof vest. The graffiti in the men's room said, "Shoot for the head." Eighteen months of hard work later, we put the company back on its feet, and I once again retired for good. A few days after that, I was in Detroit at a board meeting for auto parts maker Federal Mogul. Amid a variety of problems, we fired the chairman CEO, and I got the job as interim CEO. My first day in the corner office, I called our top 10 customers to tell them that we were going to continue the same great service that the former CEO had always bragged about. Boy, did I get an earful. They pleaded with me, "Don't do that." They considered us to be dishonest, incompetent, arrogant, and confused. And what that taught me as a board member is to make sure you've got other lines of information other than just listening to what the CEO is telling you. So anyway, in January of 97, I retired for good. And I joined one more board, the garbage collection and disposal firm of Waste Management. Now, shortly after joining the board, I was in Pittsburgh to teach a class in crisis management at Carnegie Mellon. As I was preparing my remarks for the class, the CEO called me to say he had two pieces of bad news about Waste Management. For one, the CFO had just resigned amid some serious accounting irregularities. "Can't get any worse," I said, "than that. What else?" He then explained that he himself was quitting and he left that afternoon. An emergency telephone board meeting was called, but it overlapped the class I was doing, so I missed it. I called the general counsel a couple of hours later during a class break, and I got the bad news. And that is, in my absence, the board had elected me chairman and CEO. And they were sending the company plane down to Pittsburgh to pick me up after class and bring me back to Chicago that evening to explain my plans for the company. Give me a break. 4 months later, we finished an accounting review and restated the previous 5 years of earnings reports downward. We took a whopping balance sheet write-off, and 80% of the net worth just simply evaporated. Now, one very interesting governance dilemma for me arose during this time frame when I met with 20 large shareholders representing over half the stock of Waste Management. What they told me was that Waste Management's problem was a bloated bureaucracy, so they wanted me to hire a certain famous cost-cutter CEO. So I took the name and I flew to Florida a couple days later for an interview. In my judgment, the candidate was a one-dimensional blowhard incapable of running a long-term successful business model. I declined to hire him. But I lay awake nights and wondered, what right did I have to substitute my judgment for that of a majority of the owners? As it turned out, however, the candidate the shareholders wanted was a fellow nicknamed Chainsaw Al Dunlap. He was the CEO of Sunbeam at the time, And within a couple of months, he got fired in a cooking the books scandal. So I felt somewhat vindicated. Now, we ended up doing a merger with an outfit down in Houston called USA Waste, which was the number three company in the business. And that gave us what was regarded at the time as the most respected leadership team in the waste industry. Wall Street was thrilled with the deal. Our stock went soaring. I was bursting with pride as I headed into retirement. But it turned out to be my biggest ever corporate belly flop. Within a year, the roof fell in at this new waste management. The company missed its earning guidance by a country mile. The stock lost $10 billion, or half its value, in one day. And it was revealed that most of the management team had unloaded all their stock options 2 weeks prior. So, in one day, the board fired the top five officers, and as my punishment, I had to go back to work as CEO. I found the company in shambles. The computers were so screwed up that we wrote off $500 million of untraceable accounts receivable. We had to hire over 1,100 accounting professionals from the big firms to rebuild the balance sheets at every single location where we worked. What a mess. But we kept picking up your garbage, and we recruited new leadership. The company is now completely stabilized and doing extremely well. I was now headed into retirement once again. But as I was packing up, I got a call from Bill Donaldson, a founder of DLJ and at the time a director of Aetna Insurance. He explained that Aetna had just fired their chairman, CEO. The wheels were coming off the business, and their stockholders were all up in arms. Could I help? So for nearly a year, I became half of the two-person office of the CEO at Aetna with Donaldson. We restructured the company by selling off its financial services business for about $8 billion, and then bet the ranch on fixing the very deeply troubled Aetna Healthcare, one of the nation's largest health insurers. It turned out to be a winning bet. So now it was time to retire. That same day, I went to Detroit for a Federal Mogul board meeting, and guess what? Federal Mogul earnings were collapsing, the asbestos liability claims were eating up the balance sheet, the stock had plummeted from $70 a share down into single digits, so the board fired the chairman, CEO. Now, since I had been unemployed for several hours, I got elected to step in for the second time in 4 years. After finding new leadership, I retired for good. And after a few months, I got to put my feet up. And then, right after those tragic events of 9/11, I got a call out of the blue from a director of Bethlehem Steel Corporation asking for help. The next day, I flew to New York for a dinner with a group of directors where I was elected chairman and CEO on the spot. And next morning, I bought a book about the steel business and began to bone up on my new career. Bethlehem Steel was a 100-year-old company that was the world's second-largest company a half-century ago. It employed over 300,000 people during World War II and built in its shipyards over 1,000 ships for the U.S. Navy. Its engineering division had built the skyscrapers of New York and Chicago and even the Golden Gate Bridge. It had fallen on hard times and was a shadow of its former self. Bethlehem employment had shrunk to just 12,000 active employees who were trying to support 130,000 retirees and dependents with their pensions and health care bills. 10-to-1 ratio. That dog won't hunt. We had no choice but to file bankruptcy 3 weeks after my arrival, but that didn't solve anything by itself. The ultimate salvation for these precious industrial assets involved a massive consolidation and rationalization of America's fragmented steel industry. The six steel mills I had inherited are today operating profitably as part of the world's largest steel combine. So in mid-2003, I retired for good. But it wasn't for long. In 2005, another cold call from a headhunter. Delphi, he said. The world's largest automotive parts manufacturer with hundreds of facilities all over the globe. A spinoff from General Motors that had previously been managed by Bill Hoglund, whose picture sat outside my office for the next 4 years. It had one big problem: labor contracts in the U.S. factories inherited from GM costing about $75 an hour with benefits. Of course, we couldn't compete while carrying that albatross. And forget China. We had a $3 billion annual labor cost penalty compared to other U.S.-based unionized parts makers. I stepped in as chairman and CEO. We soon ran out of money and filed a messy Chapter 11 that lasted 4 long years. I was quite vocal about the need to finally address the entitlements embedded in our labor contracts. The Wall Street Journal editorials referred to me as the Oracle of Delphi. The United Auto Workers Union called me something else entirely. To try and take the high road, I cut my pay to $1 a year. I didn't want to have to explain to our factory workers why I was being paid $1 million to tell them we couldn't afford their paycheck. But all I got, instead of gratitude, was picketers outside my office. They were carrying signs that said, "Miller isn't worth a buck." I thought it must have been a typo. Well, Delphi survived that trauma and today is a successful and profitable global enterprise. As a wonderful metaphor for all that I accomplished at Delphi, consider this. I arrived at Delphi in 2005 in a shiny Gulfstream jet. Then 4 years later, departed with Jill, dragging a U-Haul trailer down here to Naples. The lessons from Delphi go way beyond auto parts. Globalization is a fact of life these days. What has been brought into sharp relief is the differing value the global marketplace places on knowledge workers versus unskilled basic manufacturing workers. And the implications are enormous, and it boils down to this. If you want your kids and grandkids to enjoy the great American dream, make sure they get a great education. The days when manual, unskilled labor can deliver lifetime employment at $50 an hour are gone. My recent experiences, in fact, have been with three industries that have undergone profound change. As CEO at Bethlehem Steel, as a board member at United Airlines, and as CEO at Delphi. Steel, airlines, autos. What those three industries had in common was a social contract worked out over the last half century with strong centralized labor unions to elevate their workforces with elaborate defined benefit retirement programs. Back in the days when you worked for one employer till age 65 and you died at age 70, and when healthcare was unsophisticated and inexpensive, the social contract in these defined benefit programs perhaps made some economic sense. Today, defined benefit programs are an anachronism, and we are witnessing the slow, agonizing death of defined benefits as industrial compensation policy. First off, the lack of portability forces people to stay with one employer for life, even though we have a much more mobile and flexible population these days. Second, the notion of having all your retirement eggs in one basket, your employer, is a concentration of risk that is simply unwise. And finally, these legacy liability programs have a way of threatening the existence of traditional large employers. People are living longer these days. Medical science is rapidly expanding the capability to spend vast amounts of money keeping us alive for decades. Of course, that's a good thing. But the question is, who's going to pay for it? As a society, we must generate enough wealth in our working years to support our income aspirations and healthcare needs in our sunset years. Meanwhile, unions in the traditional steel companies and auto companies and so on bargained for 30 and out. The theory was you can create more jobs by retiring people sooner. But this meant that people could start work at age 20, retire at age 50, and expect full pensions and healthcare till they were 90. In other words, enjoy the fruits of your labor longer than you were at labor. As a society, unfortunately, somebody has to pay. And to the shock of the big three automakers in Detroit, they found that the customers won't pay when they have choices. My worries go beyond private industry, of course. What I'm describing is also embedded in our debates over Social Security and Medicare, because the overwhelming voltage in the political third rail of touching these entitlements has forestalled corrective action for years. But now, in places like Wisconsin, the battle over public employee union retirement benefits has broken out into the open. I fear something like intergenerational warfare, as young people increasingly resent having their wages reduced and taxed away to support social programs for their grandparents' income and health care concerns. So stay tuned for a lot of political heat as this plays out. And as for my own retirement, I am yet again a failure. I have taken on two big assignments in New York and therefore am commuting these days between Naples and the Big Apple. Got in at 2 o'clock this morning, by the way. My most noteworthy job is as chairman of AIG. This is the huge insurance conglomerate that just 2 years ago was the most hated symbol of Wall Street recklessness and a piñata for all that congressional anger over executive compensation. The managers of AIG had to move their families to hiding places to avoid the glare of publicity and the death threats. That's when I was invited to join the board. So of course I said yes. Train wrecks are what I do. And this was a fascinating front row seat to the collision between our public and private sectors. Now AIG was built over a 40-year period by CEO Hank Greenberg into the world's largest property and casualty insurer and a major force in life insurance across the globe. The company also, by the way, is a non-core business, an afterthought, includes an aircraft leasing company called ILFC. And with over 1,000 commercial airliners, it is the biggest single customer of Boeing and of Airbus. AIG was an amazingly complex organization that maybe only Greenberg could understand and manage. So after he essentially got fired by Elliot Spitzer in 2005 over alleged accounting issues, the company then wandered off course. We can only speculate whether the company would have avoided the crash landing had Hank not been forced out. By the end of 2008, AIG was considered a hopeless basket case, existing on life support amounting to $180 billion in loans and credit lines from you, the taxpayers. Most of the company's operations were still sound, but one division had run amok with credit default swaps and mortgage guarantees with over $2 trillion in nominal value. And that's what brought down the house. The game plan was to liquidate the company altogether and use the proceeds to help offset the seemingly inevitable huge loss by our government. But with the arrival of Bob Benmosche, our new CEO, in mid-2009, we switched gears and decided we could rebuild the company. Then last summer, we had that very embarrassing public spat between our CEO and our chairman, including the abrupt resignation of our chairman, Harvey Golub. The board governance committee huddled while I was checking my flight schedule for the next trip back to Florida. To my utter surprise, they asked me to take over as chairman, and they gave me 10 minutes to decide. So I called Jill and explained that this could disrupt our plans. And she said, "We don't have any plans." As things now stand, we have completely repaid all of AIG's obligations to the Federal Reserve, and we have converted all the U.S. Treasury claims into common stock of AIG, which Treasury plans to sell in the near future. But here's the astonishing part. If the current market price holds up, then the taxpayers will walk away with a huge profit measured in billions. Say my, it could be, you know, $10 billion, $15 billion, who's counting? My favorite Wall Street Journal headline, you know, had a, when we first started talking about this a few months ago, had my picture underneath a big headline that said, AIG to US, keep the change. Anyway, The net result of this is that the bailout may have avoided a global economic catastrophe, returned a profit to the government, and left behind a viable and well-capitalized company that will be the world's leader in property casualty insurance and employing tens and tens and tens of thousands of people. So all I can say is thank you, the taxpayers, for giving the people of AIG a second chance in life and the opportunity to prove their worth. We could not have done it without your help. Of course, the bailout of AIG continues to generate controversy. Think of it. In September of 2008, when everyone thought the world was at an end, AIG got over $100 billion in support. 100 times that Chrysler bailout in 1980 that had taken me 9 months of hard work before we got the first penny. In contrast, AIG got bailed out over a weekend. Heck, I waited longer in line for service at Starbucks. But whatever the rationale, I am grateful we had some savvy leaders in Washington with the cojones to do something. They had 2 days to decide it as the financial markets were collapsing. We've now had 2 years to second-guess those decisions, and I can't think of a better answer. There are some pundits who think AIG should have been allowed to go bankrupt, just like Lehman Brothers. We will never know, but the entanglements of AIG might well have sunk the entire global financial system. For certain, AIG could not have survived any better than Lehman did, and underneath it all is a problem I see in the bankruptcy process in the U.S. First off, bankruptcy takes a lot longer than you'd think. In business, there's a premium on the speed of decision-making. You get everybody in a room, decide what to do. In bankruptcy, there are enormous institutional impediments to speedy resolution. I liken the process to a bunch of kids fighting over an ice cream cone while it melts. Second point, it is incredibly expensive to go broke. The company has to pay for the lawyers, financial advisors, accountants, and consultants, plus similar groups for all the creditor constituents, all the other stakeholders. The system was designed by lawyers for the benefit of lawyers. It's a real pig out by the professionals. At Delphi, the total tab came to $500 million over 4 years. I thought that was a shocker. And to think of how many jobs we could have created by investing that money. Today at Lehman Brothers, the tab for professional fees has already gone well past $1 billion. And that's for a company that's simply liquidating. The incentives in this system are all wrong. The concept of pay for value does not exist. Instead, it is pay for effort expended. There is no reason for anyone to hurry up and get it done. In fact, if you get your job done in half the time, you just lost half your paycheck. As a businessman, I'd be willing to pay professionals twice as much if they could get us to emergence in half the time. But that would be heresy at the courthouse. Beyond the direct costs, there's the far larger cost to the business, caused by the distraction of management in serving the process. Important decisions are deferred, opportunities missed, customers go elsewhere to avoid uncertainty. As I sat in Detroit in early 2009 in the fourth disheartening year of Delphi's case, I pondered the inevitable bankruptcies of GM and Chrysler. I thought those proceedings could take 10 years or more and totally destroy those companies. For better or worse, the Obama administration realized how incapable our bankruptcy process is for dealing with these huge multinational conglomerates and directly intervened. We had the spectacle of the President of the United States publicly bullying the secured lenders at Chrysler, forcing them to yield their rights in order to jam through a bankruptcy in 5 weeks, turning all claims priorities upside down. The politically powerful United Auto Workers Union came out unscathed by the bankruptcy, while other creditors, dealers, and stockholders got blown away. Whatever you might think about that particular exercise of power, it is an incredible indictment of the normal bankruptcy system that other less politically well-connected companies are doomed to deal with. So anyway, I mentioned I had taken 2 assignments in New York. My second job is chairman of a middle market private equity firm named MidOcean Partners. We invest in companies and work to make them better. Brands we own you may recognize include Sbarro's Pizza, Tote's Umbrellas, Bushnell Optical Gear, and Hunter or Casablanca ceiling fans. We're also into cable TV, business marketing services, community banks, pet food. Our biggest splash, now sold, was Jenny Craig. Think about it. Eat our pizza, go to Jenny Craig. We've got you coming and going. Looking at the big picture, the past decade has seen a flood of private equity capital taking over many of our iconic companies, replacing the previous public stock ownership format. It has been fueled by the increased willingness of investors, from government pension funds to wealthy individuals, to place their faith and their money in the private equity business model. The bigger question for me, why are public companies losing out to private equity in this way? For one thing, private equity marches to a different drummer. At a public company, you focus on your quarterly accounted earnings per share. I've never been to a private equity meeting where anybody asked how are your GAAP earnings coming along. Instead, how's your cash flows and how's the wealth creation coming along? Another factor is Sarbanes-Oxley. We have crippled all of our public companies with the huge compliance costs embedded in Sarbanes-Oxley. And it's not just the compliance cost, it's all the hijacking of the attention of the board of directors away from strategic issues. It used to be that a board had two basic questions. Do we have the right strategy? And do we have the right management to execute the strategy? Get that right, company's going to be okay. Now the boards are required to double-check and triple-check the math being done by the finance office and the external auditors. It's important to, more important to document the past than to plan the future. I call it sitting in a vehicle with the driver's seat having been unbolted, turned around, facing out the back window. You have to focus on where you've been much more than you are allowed to focus on where you're going. Private equity is freed from these chains of Sarbox and can much more comfortably make gutsy decisions about where they want to go. I'd bet on private equity just on that governance matter alone. But another sore point has to do with executive compensation. As chairman of AIG, I now sit at the epicenter of this great public debate over management comp. Our biggest challenge as a board now is to attract and retain and motivate talented managers. Yet as we strive to pay off the government and then cope with all the incredibly complex restrictions we have on what we can pay people and how. There is a deep pool of political hostility to management comp at taxpayer-supported companies in general, and all public companies for that matter. The word bonus has become so unpopular it's hard to design a good variable compensation program to reward excellent performance. Meanwhile, at private firms, they can set compensation schedules however they want. They don't have to tell you because it's none of your business. But the one thing I can tell you is that the managers who create wealth will get rewarded appropriately in a private equity setting. So I think that competition for talent is another advantage private equity has. I know there's a lot of political pressure to put further controls on the accounting disciplines and executive pay structures at publicly held companies. But I seriously worry that we're going to end up with the nirvana of perfect regulation of public companies and with all business having gone private. On top of that, we are making life so difficult for all the U.S. companies that America, I think, is losing its preeminent place in global finance. A lot of companies are choosing not to list here, and as one indicator, you may have read, the New York Stock Exchange may soon be owned by the Germans. Anyway, I think I've said enough. I very much appreciate all of you having listened to my story. And with that, we'll take your questions.
Well, Steve, as you can expect, there is a number of questions for you. So let me go kind of around. Not in order of importance, but we'll start with some AIG questions. 92% of AIG is owned by the federal government. When will the government shares be replaced by private equity?
Well, the point is we're going to sell the treasury shares onto the stock market, and therefore there'll be a broad public holding. So it may take two or three tranches to get it done. Could take a couple of years to get it done because any one of these tranches will probably be the biggest stock sale into the stock market in history. But the clear objective of the government, and believe me, it's our objective, is to get this job done. And hopefully, when we're done, you will all, as taxpayers, have realized a big profit.
Second question on AIG, and it's around Greenberg, and several questions on Greenberg. Was the termination of Hank Greenberg appropriate?
Well, I'm so glad I wasn't there at the time, so I don't even have to answer the question. There were some serious questions raised about the accounting and some transactions that looked a little weird between AIG and Warren Buffett, you know, for example. But I haven't wasted any of my time trying to worry about Hank. I mean, Hank is he's a wonderful person. He's a wealthy individual. He's doing just fine. But he's mad at me for cutting a deal with the government. He says, Steve, you should have sued the government. Look what they did to the old shareholders. And my view is if the government hadn't come to help us, there would have been nothing left here for anybody. So, you know, whether you like it or not, our job is to make the best of the way things are and try and create a bright future for all the people that work at AIG.
This is kind of a three-parter, but it's really going one direction. Is American General and Accident Insurance still part of AIG? Does the Carl Lindner family still control it? Should I worry?
Well, for lots of reasons, you should worry about where things are going in America. We have a lot of very serious issues that politically we just aren't capable of addressing. But as Carl Lindner, I haven't seen hide nor hair of him anywhere around the AIG assets. I forget what you asked about. American General, we sold. It was too much weight on our balance sheet to get done what we needed to do. And I forget what other one you asked.
But we'll go to the next one.
Okay, next one.
Do you think Goldman Sachs should have gotten 100 cents on the dollar for their AIG exposure?
That is the political hot button of all time. That when AIG was going down at a time when the market valuation of all financial assets was really in the ditch, and a lot of our assets where we were counterparty with Goldman Sachs had to do with mortgages and everything else. Nobody wanted to touch them. Not only was the market down, there was no market whatsoever for these things. Goldman Sachs was doing collateral calls. We had a lot of fights back and forth between AIG and Goldman Sachs as where that was appropriate. Now, had AIG gone bankrupt like Lehman, then it would have been punitive not only on Goldman Sachs. It might have utterly destroyed the capital adequacy of every financial institution across the globe. That's how big $2 trillion is when you think about it. And therefore, the government decided, okay, to pump money in. But they did it on a weekend. They didn't have time, you know, to take 2 years to negotiate, you know, what's a fair value or whatever. So they pumped the money in order to refloat AIG. And one of the prices that was paid for that is that all of the counterparties of AIG all of a sudden, you know, were able to get full value for what AIG owed them. Was that fair? Was it just? I don't know. All I know is we got saved, AIG, and we still have a financial system on planet Earth here that seems to be able to cope. So the outcome to me is the test.
Some personal questions. What are the key principles or actions that are common across all your successful turnarounds?
Okay, across all the turnarounds, I've kind of got Miller's 5 points. One is you need a change of leadership in order to do a turnaround, and that's because it's only a new leader, typically an outsider, you know, everybody from Iacocca at Chrysler, you know, on through, whatever you want to say. A new leader can come in and you don't have to apologize for how it got so bad. You don't have to agonize over what could I have done different. You can spend all of your energy focusing on how do we get out from here. So new leadership is one. Secondly, you've got to be decisive. Wherever I go in, like, you know, steel business or construction business, doesn't matter. I don't know anything about the business. All I know is I'd better start making some decisions within 2 weeks, even if I'm very uncomfortable about my knowledge base. You need to get the organization saying, we're going to take that hill, and you get the organization energized. It matters less whether it's the perfect strategy. It matters more that you made a decision. Thirdly, you got to listen to your customer, because the customers are quite often stirred up, and if you can't make them happy, nothing else will matter. Fourth is organizational streamlining. Quite often a company gets in trouble, is very bureaucratic, and you just need to, you know, take out whole layers of management. You've got to find the young people who are passionate and want to succeed, get them into positions of power, give them authority. And then fifth, the one last thing I would say, even the most disreputable companies aren't filled with a bunch of bozos in their ranks. They have a lot of talented, knowledgeable people who know their craft, who want to do well. If you can just give them the right direction, look at AIG.
New question on that. Is there a double dip in the cards, or how big is the next market dip correction?
I'm actually short-term bullish, long-term bearish. And why do I say that? I think short-term, I can just, you know, feel the momentum starting. People are tired of the recession. They're going out shopping again. At our, you know, my Mid-Ocean is invested in Sbarro's Pizza. We track, you know, the shopping mall traffic every day. And it's starting to, you know, come back. It has recovered a lot. And if you look at a lot of other, you know, indicators, things are seem to be doing well. So you'd say, okay, we're now in a cyclical upturn. What I'm worried about is 5, 10, or 20 years down the road, because the entitlement problems and the, you know, continuing growth of our public sector, and how is that going to be financed other than by extracting tax revenues out of the private sector, which may suppress things. So I don't think we're going to, you know, hit the wall here in a year or two or three, but I'm worried about, you know, my children and grandchildren, you know, having the kind of life that we all have enjoyed. And I, you know, the sooner we can get people to address the issue, and whatever you think about the governor of Wisconsin, at least he has stood up for what he believes needs to be done.
Three questions and we'll end it. Where would the USA be today without TARP?
That's a question, you know, that only God can answer, and then it's really above my pay grade to figure that out. I mean, I look at the people in Washington, you know, with the TARP and with all the other measures they brought to bear, you know, pumped a lot of money into the system. They propped up companies that, whether you like it or not, we were very dependent on. And I fear what would have happened had we not had the TARP mechanism. I admire the people who had the guts to just do something, as I said before. And all we know is, you know, life seems to be coming back to normal now. Some of these big companies that looked hopeless, like AIG or Citibank or whatever, have come back to life. And so we know that part worked. What we don't know is how bad the failure might have been, how bad the catastrophe could have been had there not been that mechanism. So it worked. Was it the perfect answer? I don't know, but here we are.
Do you want a softball?
Okay.
Here's a question and a comment from three different people. What are you going to do when you retire? And the comment is, and it's said several different ways, why not leave the private sector and run for our president?
That's just an astonishing question. But, I mean, you know, I don't think I could stand being in politics. I mean, if you put yourself up running for office, you know, the amount of things that will be thrown at you, stuff that you did in your life you'd totally forgotten about, will be, you know, brought to bear, and the personal character assassination, I think, is just frightening. And I think it's a real problem, getting, you know, competent people to be public servants. I admire the ones who do, and I really regret the fact that there's a huge talent pool that probably won't even touch public service like that. I think what I've found in my own way, whether it's Bethlehem or Chrysler or AIG, is a way of doing public service, but in a format that I'm comfortable with, where I think I can add value. As to when am I going to retire? 1993.
Oh, you say I can. I think we all knew that this was going to be very special, but I think it also surpassed all of our expectations. It was absolutely spectacular and very important. And I hope that Randy and Steve both will accept our invitations to become members of the Forum Club. But we don't want any changes in our way we're doing things. We're on the right track, I think. Thank you, and we'll see each other again on the 8th of April, I hope.